At this time, we're going to call the House Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect, the time is 1:04 p.m. The day is Monday, February 15th, 2010. Today we have Representative Tuck, Guttenberg, Edgman, Olson, my friend Peggy Wilson, and Chair Newman. Representative Johnson is excused. We do have a quorum. Today we're going to bring back House Bill 308 by Representative Craig Johnson. It's Alaska's Job Security Act. And we wanted to try and make sure that we had some answers to the ongoing discussion that we started last week and some of the numbers that were going to be put forward. Dan Dickinson is here, so we're trying to make sure we're taking the best advantage of time that we've got. Excuse my remiss in mentioning that Representative Johnson, I believe, is listening in, so Craig, we're with you. So Dan's going to give us some more technical overview of HB 308. Going to recap a few of the items he addressed in the last presentation, along with covering sections 2, 4, 5, and 6 of 308, addressing some of the testimony given during the last hearing on 308. And we do have Representative Seaton here. He was out making sure he had all his information, I'm sure. So why don't you come on forward, Dan, and we will continue to do this. And again, glad we got our new television here so we can watch everything. Do you need a pointer for what you're doing, Dan? Got one?
Got one.
Okay. And just it's better for the public if we're trying to talk about this. They don't have all the information that we did, so you can point to that if you will. Questions from the committee as we go along, just raise your hand. We'll recognize you and continue to move forward. Okay, Dan, you know the gig?
I do. Mr. Chairman, my name is Dan Dickinson. I'm a CPA in local practice, been hired by the LB&A committee to help work on some legislation, and I may have just pushed the wrong button. I had a presentation here, and hold on. Might just take a second to be warming up.
Okay, everybody's got the presentation?
Everyone except for me. Let's try that again. Here we go. Okay.
And just for the committee, there is, if you notice the dates, this is dated February 15th, and then there's a February 8th version, so I was making sure that everybody's clear that we're on the correct one, and members of the audience, I believe there's copies outside. We'll get more if we need them.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you said, what I intend to do is simply follow up from the presentation that I started about a week ago. If members will recall, there were really identified six issues in the bill to discuss. The first one, which was an issue of the interest rate, and then the issue of the progressivity, were the two issues I was able to speak to some a week ago. And if there's certainly time or people have questions on that, we can pull that presentation up and go back and look at those. And what I hope to do today was to deal with the other four issues. What I've also done is the Department of Revenue was here I believe on Wednesday, and they raised some very good issues. They also raised some issues that I don't agree were quite as good. What I want to do is address those, including I think they gave a very good background on some issues and continue to say keep that dialogue going, make sure that all that information is part of what you're getting.
And for the committee, Dan Dickinson made a very good point there with the administration and some of the issues that they were working on. And if you remember, Representative Johnson, in his closing comments, talked about wanting to continue to move forward on the issues that in the governor's new legislation that he's introduced with increasing credits for exploration, and what Representative Johnson's trying to do with his jobs creation bill. With looking back at some of the changes that he's making in ACES, that they agreed on the good things, or what they both had in like agreements on, and we'll continue to move forward to do that, to try and create more jobs and investment in Alaska. We'll agree to disagree on the other ones. We'll continue to debate that, and I think Dan's going to kind of look at a little bit of that too, and that's the concept that we brought here together today is how we can continue to move together in that way. And again, with what the governor's doing, with Representative Johnson's doing, good ideas on both sides, and we'll continue to work that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, there are two issues. The governor's proposed legislation, essentially, well, I guess you call issue number two up here and issue number five. There are portions that line up with the legislation that I've seen, or proposed legislation that I've seen circulated. So when we get to those issues, I'll deal with them. If I can very quickly, the two slides that are still in the front, one of them just sort of lays out the structure of the bill so that we can figure out what section we're looking at. I think what I try to make clear, most of the bill, in fact, is just due to a minor technical housekeeping change. And the substantive portions of the bill, there really are six substantive sections, and those are the ones that I'm going to focus on today. So the first issue I would like to deal with is the concept of interest not being due on retroactive reg changes prior to those regs' implementation. So why is that an issue? The production tax is due on the last day of the month following the month of production. So when I produce in January, then on the last day of February, I have to pay taxes on that production. Royalties works the same way, and that fundamentally is the cash flow that keeps the state going.
And Dan, just on that point to make sure we clarify that, and that's because the state gets that option to switch back and forth. Is that, I mean, how, when the state's taking royalties on gas and oil every 30 days, they have that option. Is that why that's?
Mr. Chairman, the option to take, actually, you have to, every 30 days you can change royalty, whether it's in kind or in value, but it's going to be forward-looking by, I believe, 120 days. Yeah. In other words, you can't simply say next month I want to do it one way or the other, because people have to have contracts, they have to have shipping commitments and things like that.
Yeah. I'll make sure we're clear on how that affects that. Representative Gunn.
And how often has the state done that change from in kind to?
Representative Gunn, through the chair, I would say there's probably roughly been 20 royalty in kind contracts on the North Slope. Over the, 33 years. And Cook Inlet, it's something I can certainly look up. In fact, I've got the documents here if you want to look it up. But on the North Slope, sort of the larger size, I think about 20 times.
Okay, maybe we'll get back to that later, but thank you.
Okay, Representative Seaton.
Thanks. I just want to make sure I didn't miss something. Does the tax rate have anything to do with the switching royalty in kind, royalty in value?
Representative Seaton, to the chair, no. The tax rate, whether it's in kind or in value, the royalty is exempt from taxation.
Okay. And we do have Representative Kawasaki here with us. Go ahead, Dan.
So I produce in January, I pay my taxes in February, or I make an estimated tax payment in February, and then something may happen in March or April or May or a year later or 2 years later or 3 years later. And sometimes, for example, when there's a retroactive change in the tariff, it might be it's been through a full appeals process at the FERC or the RCA, so it might be 4 or 5 years later. If additional tax is due because the value of the oil changed, when I pay that tax, or I'm not the fortunate one, but when the taxpayer pays, they have to pay it with interest all the way back to the day on which the original payment was due. In other words, the tax is figuring about the value of the oil when it was produced, and so when the value changes, the interest component runs all the way back to the very first time that the tax was due. Now, in a settlement, for example, and let's continue this case of a retroactive revision of the tariff, the department, it's explicit in law, the amount of the tax can be compromised. Let's say that the two parties each have, you know, the state says, well, gee, here's what you should have done, and the taxpayer says, well, here's what I did, and both sides look at the other one and say, well, that sort of makes sense, but, you know, one way isn't clearly right and one way is clearly wrong. It's an interpretive issue. The rules weren't clear. The department, rather than pursuing that all the way through and getting a judge to finally figure out what the words mean, they can say, okay, well, we'll settle this. Sometimes if there's a penalty involved, that the Department of Revenue and with the Attorney General's advice can also settle the penalty, but there's no mention about interest. They can't change the amount of the interest due. So what the situation we find ourselves in now is, back in 2007, there was, of course, the ACES bill that passed, and there were several major things that changed, and very explicit directions were given to the Department of Revenue to write regulations. One of the major ones was in the Department of the Rural Transportation. In other words, the cost for taps and for tankers for oil. And what the new rule says is it's going to be the lower of what your costs are or what the department determines reasonable costs are. And I don't want to, you know, this is not the place to debate whether that's a good idea or not, but here's the point. the department hasn't yet said how it's going to calculate what those reasonable costs are. So a taxpayer is now typically paying costs, deducting what they pay for taps. The department at some point is going to publish regulations and say, here's what we think, here's another standard, a different standard. A taxpayer might owe more money, and the point is they won't know how much, though, until those regulations are published. Another area, another major area is...
Just on that point, though, Dan, what I think where you're trying to get on that is because the regulations are currently being written, there's changes that are being done, that it's not retroactive then on what they pay because that regulation hasn't been written yet. So if there's a further amount due, they don't have to pay interest on that increased amount because they didn't know what it was.
Representative Newman, through the chair, that's what the proposal in this bill and the governor's bill is, they wouldn't. Because if you don't make that change, then a taxpayer would have to pay when that regulation is finally implemented. So let's say those regulations, there's a new draft that was put out for discussion now. Let's say that they're implemented 6 months from now, so July of 2010. Someone's going to figure out, okay, I produced this oil in, you know, July of 2007. My tax on it just changed, and I have to submit that with 3 years' worth of interest. Similar dynamic is going to be concerned with the notion of what's an upstream cost. Transportation, of course, is downstream. It's what happens after you've left the lease. On the lease, the legislature said for a producer's cost to be deductible, for it to be considered a lease expenditure, it has to be allowed by the department by regulation. In other words, the department has to come out and actually write regulations. So those regulations, which are going to affect 2007, were just adopted in the last, basically the last quarter. So people have to go back for two years and figure out what their additional tax they may owe as a consequence of those regulations. Another thing, production tax is a yearly tax. Yeah. Remember those?
On that point, Representative Seaton had a question.
Thank you. And was that limited by the standard deduction methodology so that those regulations are really only going to be currently applicable because the lease expenditures were limited by the percentage increase, so that the regulations weren't really necessary at that time?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, for the production from the two fields that were limited by the 165 J&K, that's a parody of a standard deduction, so I'm not going to, I prefer not to use that terminology. But for the limitations under 165 J&K, what you clearly would not be affected for 2007, 2008, and 2009 by the definition, because the rules for 2006 were under, which lay the base, which then increases by 3% a year, were defined under it. This requirement was not there, that the department define it by regulation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The production tax is a yearly tax that you make 12 estimated payments, and then in March you true it up. When the reforms were introduced, a lot of them were effective in the middle of the year, and so you have to figure out how to take the two things that you have and meld them into a single year. The department took several years to write the regulations on that. There were new reporting requirements, new rules for exploration credits, and this basically summarizes where the department is on these packages. So basically, you can see the reporting requirements were published in May, effective June of 2008.
Can you use the pointers so people are trying to watch this?
Yeah. So the first one I call I'm on slide 7, the reporting requirements to tell people what it was exactly that they had to report became effective in June of 2008. The next project was an omnibus, a catch-all, a very large 35 sections of the regulations were changed, including this notion of what the mid-year statutory changes were. And those were adopted in September of 2009 and became effective in October of 2009, so basically looking back at a year and a half. The notion of when lease expenditures became effective was adopted in the exploration credits also in November of 2009, became effective in December. The notion of the lease expenditures, what are the actual costs on the lease that are going to be allowed to be deducted? Those were adopted last month, so they will become effective the month we're in. The transportation, what constitutes a reasonable cost of transportation, is not was not, is, still have not been adopted, and as I said, the last public draft came out in February of this month. That is, there are three earlier discussion drafts that have been released. And then finally, there's a bunch of smaller projects that are on here that will also have, may have retroactive effects. Some of them may not. But the point is, of these major projects, basically a period of close to 2 years went by during which the taxpayers don't necessarily know what their obligations are. So Governor Parnell's approach was to go in and change what's called the Section 020I, and it says interest will be waived. If you compare that with the approach in the CS that's in front of you, it is more explicit, and it's really there are two things that it makes explicit which the current bill doesn't, and it's which, why I think the folks ought to consider maybe looking at the governor's language instead of the CS language here. The first one is that it recognizes this notion that just because there aren't regulations doesn't mean there aren't any rules. There was still something in place. There was still some guidance. It's not a question of do I owe any interest or no interest on a retroactive payment. It's what standard. It's almost like you have to go out and figure out, well, here's what you would have owed under the just the statute, and here's what you owe under the statute with the regulations that have been adopted, or here's what you would owe if you had kept the regulations that were in place that haven't been changed, and then they're changed. So there's lots of different ways of thinking about how much you would have owed had there been regulations. What's the difference between what you paid under the existing rules? The second thing, which is that it's very explicitly retroactive. I think one of Representative Johnson's concerns in the CS for 308 was he does not like retroactive rulemaking. He does not like taxes to be done retroactively, and I think that's in general is a makes a lot of sense. However, the situation you have here is basically something was going from 2007 through current. It is a retroactive situation, and the only way to address it is by being expressly retroactive. And so what the governor's bill does is it very, you know, expressly says we're going to change this rule retroactively, regulations to implement it can be done retroactively, and it adopts the principle of retroactivity.
Yeah. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dan, so if I'm hearing you correctly, the tax goes back retroactive, but the interest does not.
Representative Wilson, through the chair. That's correct. Under both these approaches, the tax is always going to be retroactive. The amount of money owed isn't going to change as a consequence of this. It's just who's bearing the interest for it. Okay. And a final reason, and this may be trivial or may not be, but if you adopted the governor's approach, then you don't have to do the restructuring, and so the CS literally half of the sections disappear, because what those sections were just in there for was every time in the statute book the interest section was referenced, it had to change a reference from section 225 to 225A. And so if you don't have a 225B, then you don't have to do that, and you literally the number of pages and sections being affected. So in some senses it's a lot simpler. I was just going to finish one thing, because this may be confusing to people. In the current CS of 308, all the changes were a change to Section A, but then when 225 itself was changed, the little A parens were not introduced. So there may be some confusion looking at how that all ties together. But.
I have questions from Representative Seaton and Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dan, is there a difference and what is the applicability to production tax and other taxes in these two bills? Are they identical? Does one of them just deal with production tax? Does one of them deal with a myriad of taxes that could be due under the state taxation system?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the governor's bill just deals with the issue of the tax of production taxes. The CS before you would have this effect. It changed in two places, but the implication is it would affect, I believe, everything, all taxes.
And just to make sure that we're clear on that, taxes on what?
Excuse me?
This is just production taxes?
The governor's provision is in 4355, which is just dealing with the production taxes. The CS deals with 05, which is the Title 43, so it would deal with interest on all taxes.
And then there was some discussion on exploration credits.
That's the next point down.
So we'll get there.
You'll get there.
Representative Tuck.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to, and I think we kind of verified it, but I just want to verify that the governor's bill also doesn't make interest retroactive, but still the taxes are owed. Is that correct, or is he alleviating the taxes owed as well?
Representative Tuck, to the chair, no. The governor's bill does not alleviate the tax. The tax stays. This only deals with the interest issue.
And then with this substitute, and that's only for production tax, but the substitute that we have in front of us is affects everything, including production tax. And does that also, I know that that also waives the interest, but does that also waive the taxes owed?
Representative Tuck, to the chair, no. Both the CS and the governor's bill only deal with the interest issue.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just making sure the clarification in the CS that you just mentioned earlier would be found on page 2. I'm sorry, page 3, section 6. And you're talking about line 4 would be section 4305225A.
Representative, correct. On line, is that 4 or 5? Yeah, 4. You're right.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Trying to get a little more handle on this. So 308 would affect all taxes. The governors would do production taxes. But it looks like the governor's is a non-discretionary. Now, is this on settlements too, or I mean, if there's a negotiation and there's a settlement that comes out, then this means that it's not discretionary and interest is waived on the settlement amount?
Representative Seaton, through the chair. I think this affects settlements and non-settlements the same way. What happens now is if there is a settlement of an issue, basically you figure out what the issue is and then once how much what the settlement numbers will be, and then typically you then crank interest through on top of that. So when people are doing a settlement, sometimes the negotiation is by dollar amounts. More typically it's by issues. And one of the first things you do in a settlement discussion is identify the amount of each issue. And if I can just preface this, you know, I was the director of tax for the state for 7 years in the Murkowski administration, the Knowles administration, and that was the practice then. I can't speak for the department now, so I want to make sure I'm not putting words in anyone's mouth. But that was certainly the practice then, and then during the – I also served for many years, worked with a settlement counsel who was working with DNR on the major Amerita Hess litigation. And that was, again, the same way. So that typically, you isolate the issue, you deal with it, and everyone's aware of the interest that's tagged with it. The language that I showed you earlier says that in a settlement, neither the Attorney General or the Commissioner of DNR can compromise the amount of the interest. They're explicitly said you can compromise the amount of penalty and the amount of tax due. And if I could just answer your other question, Representative Stephen, because I think it's sort of a two-part question. In neither bill, the CS or the governor's bill, is it discretionary. However, there is an important distinction, and one of the things that I would talk about is possible upgrades to the governor's language. What the governor says is, what the governor's bill, and I apologize for the small type here, I try to fit it all on one page if people want, but what the language is, because you have 308 in front of you, but what basically it says is the department has to make a determination, and I'm right here down on slide 9 in the middle, and it's the language in blue. It says the department has to make a determination that the producer made a good faith estimate of its tax obligation in light of the regulations then in effect when the payment was due. So in the sense of it being discretionary, the department first has to make a determination that they were good faith, and then the waiver automatically follows. one of the things that I'm, I believe we might consider, or that you might consider, is this notion that the department not have to make a determination each time. In other words, that's, you have to go out and figure out whether it was good faith or not. You say the interest's waived, and then if the department sees that they didn't act in good faith or they acted in bad faith, then you can charge interest. But the notion is to take away, to alleviate the burden of the department having to make a good faith determination, a determination of, again, I'm not an attorney, but the notion of good faith seems to me to be one that isn't strictly number crunching. It could be fairly problematic in making that determination. Turn it around and say interest waived, except if you see something really egregious. But so I guess it's not discretionary, but there's a determination that may or may not be discretionary, if that answers your question, Representative Stevens.
Okay, we do have Representative Wilson.
Can I follow up on that?
Yes.
And I guess what I'm trying to do is find out whether, let's say we had a dispute and there was a settlement, the producer said, yes, I owe you $100 million. And yes, I owed you $100 million. We've negotiated this down, and now we're saying, yeah, I owed you for 2 years, but I don't have to pay any interest on it. Is that the discretionary or non-discretionary point at which we're talking about now? It seems like we need some kind of check on that, because otherwise there's really no really reason to pay the full taxes, because whatever the settlement's going to be, there would be mandatory, all the interest would go away.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, if I can just distinguish sort of two parts of that answer. The first part is, this doesn't change the law as it affects settlements. So the Attorney General and the Department of, and the Commissioner still have to approve a settlement of the principal amount, and if any penalty is different than what was assessed, or the principal amount is different from what was assessed. The one case in which the interest might also be waived or be required to be waived is if the amount in dispute arose as a consequence of there not being a regulation in place and the regulation coming in after the fact. So the notion that saying, well, we'll just, you know, we're going to carte blanche and interest isn't owed, that's not what's going to be the case. In fact, just to make sort of talk about a timeline here, what we're really talking about is the period between 2000. Let's say we're talking about something to do with a lease expenditure. We're talking about something that came in. The rules came in 2007. Excuse me. The statutory requirement came in 2007. The regulatory fulfillment came in 2009, and it may be 2012, 2013 before an assessment is issued on that. Currently, the six-year statute of limitations, so it would be, let's say, 2013. The interest between 2010 and 2013 is not changed at all by these rules. All that's changed is the application of the interest before the rules were in place up until they came into place. From then on, once you know the rules, you know, once the taxpayer knows the rules and they've been promulgated, they've been adopted and they're official, and you know, there may be a 30-day or 90-day period there, but once they're finally out there, it's as if the rule had always been there. This is only dealing with the period before the rule was in place up until it was in place.
And just one final follow-up. And my understanding is that it would be all the way back for, I mean, this would only apply, this, what you said was for non-Kuparic, non-Prudhoe. Prudhoe and Kuparic were covered under the standard deviation through December of this year, so it wouldn't apply to Kuparic, Prudhoe at all either, would it?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, there are five major areas. The fixing of costs at their 2006 levels will only apply to the lease expenditures issue. The downstream transportation was not affected by that. How you mesh a 2% or a 22.5% rate and a 25% rate was not affected by that. How you deal the reporting requirements, not affected by that. So it's one small piece that would not be.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have Representative Wilson Kawasaki and Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I kind of thought I had it in my head until you answered his question, and now I'm not sure.
Sorry.
The governor's bill versus 308, in the governor's bill, it only is the production tax, but in the other bill, it said it was all of the taxes. Now, is that still just between the timeline of when it started and when the regulations were in place?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, yes. And when I said all, maybe I misunderstood what I was saying, so I apologize for trying to be so broad. The intent, I believe, and maybe we can look at the exact language, but the intent in both bills is only to deal with the issue of when a taxpayer has to file a return and doesn't know what the rules are. Okay. Then it's a question of, does that happen in the cigarette tax or does it happen in the alcohol tax as opposed to in the production tax? And so when I was using all, I simply meant the other 20 tax types of the state's 21 tax types.
Okay, thank you. That makes it clearer to me.
Yeah. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, this is directed toward the chairman. It seems like we're taking up a bill that has not been calendared before. I don't have the governor's bill in front of me, and so I have a little bit of a problem trying to talk to the differences between two bills when we haven't seen the governor's bill. The governor's people aren't here to present their bill. I think it might be a little out of order that we talk about the governor's bill until we address just what's in House Bill 308 and how it impacts the state. And so I'd prefer to stay away from the governor's bill until that's before us.
Well, I'll address that since it was addressed to me, as we had the Commissioner of Revenue here the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about the governor's bill. And he kind of went down through those points on how the governor's bill continued to look at this same issue. And the governor's bill has, one, been read across, so you've got that, and you've already got that, and you should have that in your office or somewhere, I believe. And then I kind of just wanted to make sure that, you know, because the commissioner already addressed, you know, some of this, of what where the governor's actions were on this, and how they can bring them together, what their like points were. And so that's what they wanted to try and express upon this. And again, going back to what Representative Johnson, you know, had stated, we can have our differences on stuff, but, you know, there's things that we both agree on that will make legislation better for Alaska, and we'll continue to move that discussion forward. And so I think that that's what the point is here, and what Mr. Dickinson did is go back and look at the presentation by the commissioner and look at House Bill 308 and look at those differences and likenesses, and that's what we're discussing today.
Okay, again, Mr. Chairman, I just feel uncomfortable talking about a bill that we haven't seen yet.
Well, I think you've got in your packet the presentation done by the Revenue Commissioner.
I got the presentation. I just, you know, the governor's not here to respond to any of the criticisms of a bill that we don't have in front of us today. I think it's, you know, it's appropriate to talk about 308 as a standing bill as itself and go on its merit. But I don't think that we should draw another bill into the discussion unless we plan to officially do that.
Okay. Well, we recognize the median is coming in and talking about how this was going to proceed earlier. So, as technical overview of 3.8, recapping a few items addressed in his last presentation along with covering sections, and that's what we're doing. So, go ahead, Dan. And Representative Tuck, do you have a question?
No, I didn't. Thank you.
Thanks. President Guttenberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are on page 9. We're jumping around.
And that's all I want to try to make sure. Is that where we're starting on, Dan, is page 9?
Excuse me?
We're on page 9 now.
Well, that was the question you were going to ask.
A question on page 9. We've already been to page 10.
We're all on the same page here.
Yeah.
Skipping around.
Go ahead.
Bouncing around. It's the technical term. Yeah.
Should have a ding every time we change pages or something.
Yeah.
On B, right in the middle of the page, how do you define a good faith estimate? I mean, is that a term of art, or, you know, if you've got no regulations today and you have to pay a tax bill, and you already know that tomorrow or in a month, there's a, the regs will come into play, and you pay the bill at the lower, is that not good faith, knowing that tomorrow, or the higher, knowing that the next month there's going to be a different tax rate? How do you, what is the definition of good faith?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I don't know either. I'm not an attorney, and you would have to ask someone about that, and that's specifically why I thought, because I had that same question, is to say, gee, do we really need a determination of good faith before the interest is waived? So in some ways I was speaking to the same point that you were raising here. Just to back up a second, if I can go to 50,000 feet and I think address the issue that you are raising, is the if you go back, sorry, ding, 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 but if you go back to here, what you can see is, for example, on the, let's look at the transportation regulations. There have been one, two, three, there have been four versions of them that have come out now. And so in some sense, you can look at it and you can say, well, a taxpayer should have a pretty good idea of where the department's heading, because it's not going to come out of the complete blue. The regulation process is designed. There's lots of room for public comment. And the department's being very thorough in terms of having workshops and things like that, discussion drafts, so making sure there's lots of public comment. That having been said, it does change between each draft. And so you sort of can't be in a position of saying, well, gee, here's a discussion draft, and then a week, and then 6 months later, there's another discussion draft, so now I should go back and revisit, change the changes there. Particularly on the transportation, there are, if I can be so bold, there's really sort of two very different approaches that are being considered, and sort of, does a taxpayer sort of have to figure out which one they think is likely? I think the whole notion here is that if the department has to define something, until the department, it's a long and difficult process to define it. Until they do, there really isn't a rule out there. And, does the tax department really have to go out and figure out from every draft what it ought to be paying under that draft? And that's how I would frame that question.
Mr. Chairman.
Just go ahead and follow up.
Yeah, thank you. On this page, you've dinged back to seven. At the bottom, facility sharing. Now, we haven't had facility sharing language before. Is there, or I don't believe we have, is there any impact on regs, on taxes, based upon something like that?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, that's the exact point. There's currently a rule.
Yeah.
And the rule has never mentioned facility sharing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just there's a rule. And now what the department is saying is, gee, let's create a special rule that says when you have facility sharing, now you have a special case. So the issue would, I think as you've correctly pointed out here, is until that rule's adopted, people are going to be acting as if there's not a special rule for facility sharing. It's just like any other cost. So you'd say, and certainly they're paying in good faith, so that's the law. In fact, if they were to go out and pay taxes on something based on facility sharing, and then it was never adopted, would that have been, would that have been inappropriate? So there's always a rule in place. A lot of lawyers are paid a lot of money to figure out what that rule is that you don't necessarily know. But there's some kind of a rule in place, and in that case, you're usually carving out something special or saying, here's a special case. And let me, I way overstated, because clearly when the law that you pass says the department shall define by regulation, until they do, there isn't a rule in place.
And Dan, if I may kind of expand on that and a little bit about, I think what Representative Seaton was asking is good faith. Rules change. When ACES was enacted in AGEA and different laws, in everything that we do every day, there's a cause and effect. And obviously that affects things that are in prior history and how that happens. Well, if somebody was playing by the rules at the time, and rules changed that affected something that they're doing now, they were acting in good faith. They were doing as what the rules said. You go back and they're currently writing the regulations on this because of legislation that we passed. And so there was a little hitch in there. People acted in good faith. They were doing what they're supposed to be doing. If they have an increase in taxes due, that increase in taxes is not paid with an interest because they acted in good faith. They were playing by the rules as they currently were. If there's changes in that, there's additional taxes owed, they go ahead and they pay those additional taxes or not. And that's acting in good faith. I think that's kind of the gist of what you were I mean, that's how I understand it.
That's the intent of the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Okay, I think we had Representative Seaton and then Tuck.
Thank you. And trying to get to, I think you were kind of proposing that we might want to look at changes in 308 based on something like this. That, and I understand the good faith estimate kind of language or burden would be there. Would it make more sense to have that, you know, these will be waived if the taxpayer fully paid their tax obligation under the rules that existed at the time? So that we don't have this situation, we have neither situation. We don't have the situation where somebody would underpay their taxes thinking they can avoid interest by a settlement later, but we don't have the situation where the department is having to get into somebody's mind. All they have to do is say, did you fully pay your taxes that were due under the existing regulations? And if that was the case, then the interest could be waived.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that would certainly cover many situations, but in a situation where, for example, it says a cost is a cost as defined by the department by regulation, there isn't technically a rule that applies. Let me back up. You could spend a lot of time figuring out what rule should have applied. Should I have looked by analogy to some other section of the regulations? Should I have just applied the statute directly? Should I have known these were coming? So in some places, it's very clear, as you say, here's the old rule, it gets repealed, and there's a new rule in its place. And in that case, it may be fairly simple. In many other cases, it's not that simple.
I guess.
And I think, Representative Seaton, what it does is it allows the department under ACES to make that determination. So kind of puts the ball in their court on determining if they were acting in good faith. Did they go ahead and intentionally underpay their taxes because they think that they were going to make a buck that way? You know, the department gets the decision to do that. So actually, it plays more to the department to give them the authority to make that determination.
Well, I guess you've been in the tax division. So, is your testimony that putting the burden on the tax division that on every case they have to decide whether a company made a good faith estimate of its production tax is actually going to require a lot of time and a lot of decision making? I mean, I wouldn't presume that if we're talking about, you know, millions of dollars, that those are going to be made without some kind of a formal estimate, which is a hugely time consuming and burdensome process. I mean, seems to me that there were regulations in place. And if somebody paid their taxes consistent with the existing regulations at the time, then that could be the bar, and you make it. If you didn't pay them consistent with the regulations that were in existence at the time, you wouldn't qualify.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, again, that might make sense in a lot of situations. The one that I'm asterisking is when the law changed in July of 2007. So the regulation had been written under the prior law, and sort of you had to filter through, well, what pieces apply, how well does it apply? And again, I make sure I don't want to talk out of school here, but if I can just to cite a historical example, as you know, the state of Alaska had separate accounting income tax from 1978, 79, 80, and 81. The regulations for that were not written until, I believe, 1980. So basically, you went 3 years without regulations, 1 year with regulations. When I was involved with a large hearing on this case in the 90s, so 20 years later, one of the things that was being fought about was the what rules were in place if the regs weren't there. And so, again, if I can just throw this out, you know, the conflicts, the no-brainers, there aren't many no-brainers. They don't become real conflicts unless there really are two different ways of thinking about it, and you have to work hard to figure out which one is right. You know, if it doesn't pass the red fest test, it's not an issue here. So what I'm really worried about are the times when you get the really ugly issues, such as
Dan, if I may, you know, we're on page 9 here of 40, and we got an hour left, so we're moving along at our normal pace. But what? Well, and we've got Dan for today, and I want to stress that, because I think what the meat of what we wanted to try and get into, and I'll in fact defer back to Representative Kawasaki, is, you know, 308 was a bill that reduces taxes for creating jobs for Alaskans and stuff, and that's kind of the meat of what we see in a majority of this this presentation here. Is I think there was going to be a little bit of discussion on common differences, and we're really getting hung up on that one right now. And we'll come back and ask the people who write the regulations to come back and talk to us, because those are, I think, a lot of the questions that we need to be directing to. Is, although Dan, you know, used to work for him, but let's get the people who actually are writing the regulations here to answer your questions. I think that might be probably more accurate instead of Dan's best guess. And if we may, so I just like to try to make sure we get through on how 308 affects Alaska Hire and the ability to have a reduction in taxes if there's an Alaska Hire. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I appreciate discussion, because now I got a better understanding of how this applies. But I do have a question on the good faith, if I may, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that when the procedure goes forward, the accounting team, without regulations, there's no regulations yet, but for the example where we had the facilities sharing, and under good faith, if a company was going in good faith, they would estimate possibly what that facility sharing is. And then if the regulations were then implemented later on down the road, going back, because they made a good faith effort under this bill, the interest rates would be waived under all tax schemes for them. If, however, that they did not make a good faith effort, and let's say that they did not pass the red face test and they just ignored it all completely, under this bill, would they have to owe interest because they didn't have a good faith effort?
Representative Tuck, to the chair, you're getting into attorney areas, and I hesitate to tread there because there's that's not my professional qualification.
Maybe it would be best if we can ask
but
attorneys.
But let me just make an observation on that, which is I don't think in general you would find that there is an obligation to follow regulations that have been properly adopted. And if you look at most adoption processes, and I've been through many, you know, not all regulations that get proposed get adopted. You put regulations out there because there's an issue, there's a problem, you get a lot of feedback from people affected, from the public, and the process moves on. So it's sort of like looking at a bill that may be debated. It doesn't mean it's going to be passed. That's a layperson's observation, and I don't know how an attorney would read that.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, if
hopping
I could
right along to page 10.
Let's go to page 11.
Fast.
Yeah. Ding, ding, ding. Okay, and I'm going to spend a couple of seconds here, basically looking at a tax rate tied to local hire. What the CS in front of you does is the general approach, and it's found in section 15 of the bill. It says there's a tax rate defined in section AS 4355-011E, and actually it's E1 is 25%, and the taxpayer makes monthly payments based on that rate, monthly estimates. Any direct labor that is a lease expenditure would have to be accounted for either as being resident or non-resident by a set of definitions. And at the end of the year, taxpayer could come back and say, if my non-resident rate, or excuse me, if my resident rate was more than 80%, then I get a rebate of part of my taxes. And there's essentially that establishes a new effective rate. After the rebate, effectively, the taxpayer would have paid, instead of 25%, a number between 25% and 20%. If a taxpayer's local hire rate was still had not achieved 80%, then they would pay the full 25%. So it basically goes into a sliding rate. And then the one note on this slide, which is, as you think about the bill, it certainly makes it makes sense to have it be effective the first of a year, because it really talks about a year, and so having a change in mid-year could require lots of regulation writing, people figuring out. So just one recommendation is that it be based on the beginning of a year. So what are the actual numbers involved? And I think if we look at the next slide.
Representative Kawasaki and Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question on the third bullet, direct labor, lease expenditure. I'm sorry, 12. I think it's 12. And practically, you know, the way it works, I'm asking, how would it work in a practical manner? You know, there's a lot of subcontractors up there that are obviously not residents, but working on a lease expenditure deduction. So I guess, can you run me through the practical task? Would it suddenly mean that a company that wishes to take advantage of this resident hire credit be subject to a lot of extra paperwork in order to qualify?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair.
Representative Kawasaki, that's on page 20, isn't it, Dan?
I was just going to say, I have about four pages that talk about the structure of the industry and how you have taxpayers, and then you have operators, and then you have contractors, you know, if I haven't answered the question after going through those slides, we'll go back and look at them again. But the point you've raised, Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, is a very good one, because when you think about taxpayers, looking at the Department of Labor's statistics, the taxpayers per se, the production taxpayers, comprise less than a quarter of the actual employees in the oil patch. And so it's what you identified there is a very important issue and one that is worthy of more explanation than a bullet point. So I was just trying to sum it all up there.
And I didn't mean to cut you off, Representative Kawasaki, but that's, I think, he's covering that because I cheated and went ahead with Dan earlier on this. But you are exactly right. It's all the subs and the subs. You don't want a sub, you know, being able to not pass through a credit or something like working the system, and we'll get to that.
So if we can ding back to slide 13.
On
page 12.
On page 12. Ding. Sorry about that. On the third bullet. Currently, my understanding is the department limits what an allowable expenditure is. For this to work, are we now saying that we have a new category and the state will mandate what the companies will put in to lease expenditures, as well as limit what they put into lease expenditures?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I'll address that a little more later. But let me answer your question directly. There is no mandating. The rules about what constitutes a lease expenditure are what will be established by the department, or what has been established by the Department of Revenue through their rules. Then a separate test says of the labor in that, and that's a huge asterisk, and there's several slides on what we mean by that. But of the labor in that, you either classify it as resident or non-resident, and that's where you come up with your ratio. But your point, I think the point you're getting to is how you define the labor in that. The folks from, for example, John Larson talked a lot about overhead. You know, overhead is an allowable cost. Do you go back it's an allowable expense as a formula, but do you go back and look at the labor that replaced? What if they're fixed price contracts, turnkey contracts, things that aren't actual bills for labor? How will that fits in? Very important, and I'll deal with that later.
Okay. When we get to it later. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So to go to the numbers, what this table simply shows is how the resident hire ratios on the two left-hand columns actually translate into an effective tax rate after you've had your rebate. I started here at 70% because, as we'll see later, that's what the Department of Labor and Workforce Development currently says that is the average rate in the oil patch. So basically what you'll see here is from 70% up to 80%, the amount of the rebate is zero. The conversation about the value of this rebate or the resident hire doesn't start until you at least hit 80%. So what happens is everyone would be at an effective rate of 25%. After that, say from 80% up to 82.5, for every increment, every 2.5 percentage points that you change in your resident hire ratio, your rebate changes by 2%. And as you move up until you get to the very end and the very last piece, the jump, if you will, from 97.5 up to 100 is a jump from 16 up to 20%. If I take these rebate amounts, multiply them times the nominal tax rate, the 25%, then I can sort of re-express my rebate as a percentage, and that gives me sort of what after the rebate, after all the shouting is done, what did my tax rate end up as? And as you can see, I think I talked about this before, from 70 through 80% of local higher rates, your tax effect would be at 25%. It then begins to drop, and it would hit 20 when you hit 100% local higher. So that's the structure of the rebate.
And Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the issues that was brought up by Marsha Davison, Department of Revenue, was that the step rates, the 2.5% on the hiring ratios, mean that what if a company were to say, you know, be at 70 or 82.2 or 2 or 3, and rather than hire more people, just fire more non-Alaskans to try and take advantage of the rate. Could you address that and why you didn't make it just say a, you know, just a linear slope as opposed to the step?
Representative Kawasaki.
I think we get that on page 22, yeah. Don't we?
Through the chair, I can't. What I can really say is why would a linear slope work better? And yes, I certainly address
that. You're right.
That.
You are right, Representative Kawasaki.
Yeah. And you know, maybe I'm retreading old ground as I move forward. But again, if I haven't answered your question by the time I've gone through the slides that show steps and linear things, well, that's two I'll
okay.
owe you.
Okay.
And when I looked at this, it was kind of like the student funding formula, you know, where you got page 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 in the different steps, and then finally at the end when you always see them together, then it's like, oh, okay, I get this. That's we're trying to make sure we get to that. But I want to make sure everybody's questions are answered because.
So the next slide I wanted to show is when I copped out of the Department of Labor and Workforce publication, and basically, maybe by the way, I copied, you can't really see, but basically what you're seeing is a world in which you have roughly, in 2008, you had 17,000 workers in the oil industry, and of those, about 29.8, and I'll round that to 30%, were out-of-state workers. And roughly, if you look at it here, that the number, if you go and actually compute it through, is 5,043 workers were out of state. The remainder, roughly 12,000, were state residents.
And
so,
just thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are we going to have Department of Labor here to discuss these statistics?
Right,
and they'll be up here for yeah. at the end?
When we get through Dan here,
when we get through Dan, perfect. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, the next slide, slide 15, basically just illustrates what was going on with the, basically looked at the Department of Revenue slides, and part of the problem is that sort of one number that they used got glommed onto, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but what you see on these slides is the Department of Revenue presented a change. What happens in a small incremental change, I think what Representative Kawasaki was just referring to is, in this case, it was if there was a movement of 0.5% in the resident hire rate. And as you can see, 0.5%, if it were right next to a boundary, would have a huge tax effect. They then looked at a series of larger changes that stretched all the way over 2.5%, and you have much smaller amounts. So the notion is when you have these step changes, it's very hard to say what will a change of one employer or three employees or 100 employees, what change will that make? I just quoted from the newspaper and said, gee, an extreme example, hiring one Alaskan could mean $30 million in tax savings, and that's absolutely correct. Going through the derivation here, let me jump ahead a little bit because get through this quickly because I think you're from Representative Kawasaki's question you're very focused on this issue. One of the points I wanted to make, and it's very important here though, is that if you're below 70%, and the example he just used here was the same example company C used by the Department of Revenue, let's say you know, I'm at 70% and 4,500 resident workers, and I add 650 more additional resident workers, and that brings me up to 79.98%. That's at no cost to the state for taxes. In other words, I put in quotes there at the bottom a phrase that Representative Johnson used, which is to say you need to be at 80% to start the conversation. I think he purposely chose in this bill a number that was significantly higher than where you are today. And so there's a need to move that forward. Now, on all these slides, I'll show it the above, I show it in terms of workers. In fact, the bill is written in terms of hours, and I took a very simplistic thing in my mind and said 2,000 hours a year per worker, and debate whether that's high or low, but I basically also wanted to present it so that you could see it in terms of the bill, what happens with if you just simply use that 2,000 hours per worker. But the fundamental idea here is that the Department of Revenue identified situations in which a very small change can result in a large tax change. The opposite occurs. You can have a very large change and no taxes occur. And I think Representative Kawasaki identified it precisely. It's changed from this point to this point, in other words, from, say, 8.3 or 8.278 up to 8.49 results in no tax and no change in the taxes. On the other hand, if you move from right on one side of the step to the other, you know, literally could be a one-hour difference, you'll have a huge tax effect. And so here I walk through a similar example of that. Let's say we have a large company. They have 5,200 workers, and they're at 80%, so they have a 24.5% tax rate. What happens if that company adds 162 workers? What happens to their tax? And the answer is nothing, because they've moved from 80% up to 82.49. They haven't hit the 8.5 yet. And again, so what's the answer to that? I suggested a formula, and here's what that formula would look like. I attached the bottom pieces. You could run a formula which hit the tops. You could run a formula that goes through the middles. But the point is, in a situation like this, at any given point, an extra hour or an extra worker will move you by the same amount. And so that's something for folks' consideration to get rid of the problem of this very small movement resulting in a large tax or vice versa, a very large change in resident employment involving nothing.
And as Representative Tuck.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And when you were talking earlier about the very large employment numbers and having no effect at all, you're referring to those that are already less than 80%. So they have a predominantly higher out-of-state worker. But you use the example of 162 workers for when you get into once you hit that 80% to go linear. So it's still true, even with your linear, that if you're less than 80%, that large number increase or flipping from getting rid of your non-resident workers and hiring your resident workers still not may not be able to give you a tax break for some time.
Representative Tuck, to the chair, that's absolutely correct. And this line hits and ends at 80, the linear, and you could extend it. I mean, those are choices that you can make about it. I think, and this will sort of, if I answered Representative Kawasaki's question earlier, it might cast some light on that. I think you need to look at the structure of the taxpayers before you can answer sort of the other part of your question. But yes, you're absolutely right. The 80, if you are below 80%, getting to 80% gives you no additional tax break.
Representative Kossoff, did you have a question?
Just actually more of a comment or just a thought, if it had ever been talked about, but, you know, the sort of the carrot approach being that, okay, if you hire more than 80%, you're going to get a little break, and as it goes up, you get a little bit more. But, you know, for what about companies that just aren't hiring Alaskans and are at the bottom of that? You know, we're not what are we doing for, you know, sounds like we're giving a carrot to the folks that are hiring more, but we're not giving a stick to the people that just refuse to hire Alaskans. Has it been thought that could the line be extrapolated back down? And just what's your thoughts on that?
Representative yes. Kawasaki, through the chair, that, you know, I think two thoughts. The first one is, you have to decide what your baseline is, and then your, you know, a penalty below that or a benefit above it. But I think a better way to answer your question is that we sort of think about this world of theoretical taxpayers. Let's talk about what's really happening in the patch and see if that helps illustrate the question.
And Dan, I want to just emphasize for the committee now, Dan's got some numbers of actually the number of employees there that are hired by the three major producers and subcontractors and stuff. And I think that that's probably the most important comment he said, is let's see what's actually happening up in the patch.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to sort of lead people there, but you guys are always way ahead of me, so I'm sorry if I'm sort of plodding along behind with the development they have. But let me focus on another problem, and I think actually someone in the committee raised it, and I sort of didn't take notes, and so I don't know that I know who it was. But the problem was, gee, what happens if the companies just decide to simply not report their non-resident workers? In other words, what if they say, like, they look at this thing and they say, well, gee, I'm not going to apply for a deduction. I'm going to allow my taxes to rise, but in which I'm going to take less subtraction, so my tax base will go up, and could I possibly come out ahead? And the answer is, yeah. And so I think we can walk through an actual example of how 2009 would work. Let me walk through the rounded one, which I think, as I've done on the backs of envelopes, maybe it's easier to describe to people, and you can see that roughly the numbers are the same. But let's assume that, and again, I'm looking at the entire North Slope, let's assume it's all sort of one, as if it were one big company. Let's assume that there were $10 billion was the tax base, what's called the PTV, the production tax value of all the oil and gas. And there's
Dan, please make sure that when we got those acronyms there again, because it was asked before what PTV means. And
PTV is the defined term for production tax value. I apologize for not putting all those on here. And under 4355.011E1, that is taxed at a rate of 25%. So in this case, if it was $10 billion, you'd have $2.5 billion is their total tax burden. The rebate on that could be 20% of that, or another way of thinking about that is 5% of the tax base. And so that's $500 million. So let's just assume, so keep that in mind. The maximum you could gain would be a tax benefit of $500 million. Okay. Now, how many non-resident workers were there in the industry in 2008? 5,000. And let's assume that their average wage was $100,000 a year. And again, remember, I'm doing this all in millions, so I'm putting it as 0.1, but essentially that's $100,000. So if you have 5,000 workers, each earning $100,000. It's down there, do that. It's 80, so that comes out to $500 million. In other words, it's the same figure that's up here. But the $500 million in non-resident wages, if I say, okay, I'm going to simply not report those, I'm not going to take a deduction for them, I'm going to allow my tax base to go from $10 billion to $10.5 billion. What's going to happen? Well, I'm going to have to pay $125 million more in taxes. You understand? In other words, I had all these people that were working for me. I'm allowed to deduct their costs, but I don't. So the amount of taxes I pay is going to go up. It's going to go up by $125 million, by 25%. On the other hand, if it makes my tax rate drop all the way down to 20, I've saved the difference, 500. So I've come out ahead by $375 million. In other words, the incentive was to minimize the number of non-resident hires in my lease expenditures, and by simply pulling them out, same people are doing the work, but simply not applying for them, I in fact come out way ahead. So that fundamentally, you don't want to set up a situation in which you're simply asking for that to occur, because that's not going to drive people towards hiring more Alaskans, which I think was the point here. So
Dan, as you're going through this, kind of explain a little bit too, where corporations, obviously you have a large corporation can form corporations within itself under its umbrella, so that A buys from B, buys from D, C buys from D, buys from A, and this can get pushed down the line here on who wants to report labor costs and where that is done and how the state does that. And that's a big part of, I think, what Dan was just trying to push here. And so as you go through this next few slides, keep that in mind to make sure that the state's not getting gamed on that one and how that all works.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Like I've said to those other folks, you'll see more of that on the next slide. So.
Yeah. Well, it was an important issue by Representative Kawasaki. I want to make sure his answer is his question. Thanks.
So what are some of the ways that you might fix that? Yeah, so this doesn't occur in the bill. And incidentally, I've discussed all four of these with Representative Johnson, and I think you'll see that number four here is one that, at least as he was looking at it, I think came closest to his vision of how to continue to create a structure in which the incentives were all going to be for the major taxpayers to hire more Alaskans or put pressure on their contractors to hire more Alaskans. But here are the four ways that you could look at this, or look at fixing that particular issue. First one is you can simply shift the scale. So instead of looking at resident hire affecting swinging your tax rate between 25% and 20%, it would be a swing between 25% and 24%. So a much smaller swing. It's a swing of $100 million, in which case it wouldn't be to someone's advantage to simply not make the adjustments, to not put the non-resident workers in the payroll in the deduction.
And just for the members, there is a list of the who employs the most people in your pack. They're kind of on page 28. I'm trying to make sure that people have a good understanding here, particularly people that are trying to watch this, you know, outside of this room right here. But it kind of, there's a list there on who the largest employees are and who they've got. So kind of ties into what Dan's talking about here.
And another way of thinking about this would be to put out rules that say, gee, anytime any labor is included as a lease expense, all the labor from that company has to be included. In other words, basically say, write a prohibition to law saying, well, you can't game it that way. And the problem, and I think this is what the chairman was referring to earlier, is then you get into all kinds of issues about passing through and who's hiring, and do you have a company that does a lot of labor and then they submit an invoice for a single, you know, module work over to a company that has two Alaskan employees and no one else, and then that gets submitted. So the problem with trying to put down more rules is you're kind of constantly going to have to be making ever more complex rules to get there. And that's certainly not Representative Johnson's intent. One issue, and I believe Representative Seaton, maybe I got this wrong, but I think this is one of the suggestions that you made last week, was to say, what if you focus on the new hires only? And you said, what if there was a certain amount, I think you suggested, say, $20,000 for each new Alaskan? And that certainly avoids some of these issues. One of the problems that arises in that situation is that it doesn't recognize, if there's a good corporate citizen who's already above, they have less room to move. And someone who's been really egregious in the past can now come in and start, by hiring Alaskans, can start to get a reward. So I guess part of the issue is, do you want to focus on new hires versus the overall experience? The fourth way of dealing with this structure, or dealing with this issue, is to have the Department of Revenue, have the commissioner, what the law would say is the commissioner every year will publish the figure, the amount, the tax rate. And that will be determined based on the resident hire ratios of some number, 10, 20, I don't know how many, the largest employers in the industry who are actually generating the lease expenditures. And for example, in Louisiana, this is not a local hire issue, but in Louisiana, the severance rate on tax is published every year. The commissioner publishes it, and there's a set of formulas that they have to look at and go through the thing. But it's determined every year based on something. Now, I started here by saying, given the structure of the industry, because one of the issues is going to be, wait a minute, you know, you got taxpayers, some are good, some are bad, how are you going to be penalizing people? Why are you going to base it all on one standard from the industry? And what I want to focus in on is, what's really happening in the North Slope? You have the producers. They're the taxpayers. Now, they have some employees. Certainly, BP and ConocoPhillips have a large presence here. But the employees that they have working for them, that we think of, aren't necessarily really working for the producers as taxpayers. They're working for the operators. Because what a producer does is they go out and they hire an operator to operate the field for them. And it is the operator who goes out and hires the employees that actually work in the field, although typically, much of the work that's done in the field aren't even employees of the operator, they're contractors. If you look at the Department of Labor and Workforce numbers here, the oil and gas industry, the direct employment is 4,000, and that would be for the BPs, the Conocos, the Chevrons of the world. The oil field services number is 12, you know, almost 13,000. And those are the Schlumbergers, Norcons, the folks that are out there doing a lot of the work associated with it.
So when you talk about oil and gas, that's basically the big three producers there. Those are, well, I think, what we're calling direct services as opposed to oil field service people.
So, Mr. Chairman, if you go to the Department of Revenue's handbook or their annual summary, there are 15 production tax filers, 15 entities that file production tax. And, in fact, what you'll find is there's really 12 of those are basically filing a zero return or a return for $10 or $15, I mean, basically based on their requirement to still pay a conservation surcharge for every 5 cents for every oil of barrel produced. In fact, if you walk through it, there's really only three large taxpayers and two small taxpayers. And let me walk through this. The structure on the North Slope, and I'll deal with Cook Inlet in a second, the structure on the North Slope is you have units. For example, the Prudhoe Bay unit. ConocoPhillips produces about 130,000 barrels a day from that unit. BP produces about 96,000, and ExxonMobil about 130,000. So, and then there are, Chevron produces about 4,000, and there's some very small other tax players that are down in the much smaller range below that. BP is the operator of that field. They will pass costs on roughly proportionally to how much oil each producer is being assigned. Kuparik, again, it's operated by ConocoPhillips. They're producing about 80,000 barrels a day. BP gets about 50,000 barrels a day. ConocoPhillips has a tiny piece left over from a sort of a Heritage Mobil piece, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is, it is ConocoPhillips, BP, and ExxonMobil that generally are generating most, are own most of the production from each of the fields. We have Uguruk, which is Pioneer and ENI. The majors are not a part of that. And we have Anadarko as a piece of Alpine. But fundamentally, Chevron has a very small pieces, but in several fields. But the notion is, when you look up there and you see, oh, there's all these different fields up there, but the underlying ownership lies with major three larger corporations. And they, what they really depend on is the operators. And Uguruk is operated by Pioneer, but all the rest are operated by either BP or ConocoPhillips. Cook Inlet production. Now, we're over here, so let me take this. This is the barrels a day, so we're roughly at 700,000 barrels a day. This is based on 2009 fiscal year data. Let's translate that into 1 million barrels a year, you know, just multiply by 365. It's a round number. I carry around 250,000 barrels a year, 250 million barrels a year. Cook Inlet, about 10% of that. Most of which is in gas. In other words, if we translate the gas in a barrel of oil equivalents based on how much energy is in it, you see that Cook Inlet produces about 4,000 barrels a day, but in about 25,000, the equivalent 25,000 barrels, excuse me, a year in oil. So Cook Inlet, about 10% of the production, but it's less than 0.5% of the taxes, and that's because under the current production tax law, basically, the ELF was frozen in place in the Cook Inlet through 2022, and for oil that means zero tax, and for gas that means a tax that's in the range of about 16 or 17.5 cents per MCF.
So I think what we're trying to get here on this chart is Cook Inlet production and producers is so minimal compared to Prudhoe Bay at 0.5% that.
Right, and the point I'm trying to get, moving on to the next slide, Mr. Chairman, is you know there is a credit under 4355024, which says if you have production of less than 50,000 barrels a day, you have $1 million credit a month, and fundamentally most of the taxpayers in Cook Inlet and Pioneer and the smaller taxpayers on the North Slope, as a consequence of that, have no production tax obligation other than the very small amounts that can occur under 011I or under the conservation charge. And when I talk about small, I mean really talking tens of dollars. What that leaves you with is three major producers who, roughly speaking, are picking up 43, 32, and 20%. I usually think of as 44, 33, and 22 because that's so we can remember it. But basically, those three are covering about 95% of the taxes. Anadarko and Chevron, and remember, they are producing less than 40,000 barrels a day, so a significant portion of this 3%, this 2%, in fact, is covered by the $1 million a month credit. So it's basically going to be three taxpayers that are paying about 97, 98% of the tax, two taxpayers picking up the last piece, and no one else. Why is that important? It's because if you look at who the employers are in the oil and gas,
excuse me. Representative Tuck here.
Thank you. Just for my notes, percent of NS, what does NS mean?
North Slope.
North Slope, okay.
My apologies, yeah. And I just realized that no places that say that, that whole top box is our North Slope field, so I apologize for that.
And then the good stuff where he's going is on the next page.
Okay. So then let's go to the Department of Labor. And again, I just want to make sure that people understand, when I talk about who's paying tax and who isn't, that's based purely on my sitting there with the back of an envelope with a pencil. I have not seen anybody's tax returns. I'm not revealing anything. You know, that to some degree is confidential information. This is just doing stuff on the back of an envelope. But I'm pretty certain about my conclusions. If you go to who the largest employers are, and I combined two documents here. One of them talked about the top 100 employers, the 100 largest employers in Alaska. And then another one was looking at oil and gas, and they picked up two smaller operations. What you'll see is you have the three highlighted companies, BP, Conoco, Chevron. Those are operators. Those are folks who actually go out and operate fields. And they're in there. That's probably where you're getting your 4,000 direct employees. Everybody else, all the rest of the work being done there is being done by oil field service companies. And I also highlight something, that in this survey, I went to those two categories only, oil and gas extraction, oil field services. There's something called catering and security, in which a number of, for example, native corporations are involved, and I believe they have a very large presence on the North Slope. Engineering, obviously a lot of companies are doing engineering work on the North Slope. Communications, all, you know, most of the systems that are maintained there are third-party systems being maintained by companies. Construction, a lot of construction work going on. So those are all areas of the industry that are serving the North Slope. And yet, you know, what people tend to focus in on is these jobs. So the point I'm trying to make is, I think what Representative Johnson was trying to set up is a situation where, I think as he'd say, the market forces are working. I don't want to put words in his mouth because he's not here, but the notion is ConocoPhillips and BP are going to go out and make hiring decisions or on who they're going to contract for, excuse me, contracting decisions. And what he wants them to be saying is the workforce, how your workforce is constituted, the number of residents that you have in your workforce is an important bid variable. Somebody who comes to us with a 80 or a 90% Alaskan workforce is more valuable than somebody who could perform the exact same service but with a 50% workforce. So he's trying to shift that emphasis so that the employers are out there, or the people hiring the contractors are out there saying, you have to do a better job of employing Alaskans, and the employers themselves are then going to go out and do what they have to do so that that feeds back. And the point I keep coming back to on this is, I think of the four options we went through earlier, the one that looks at the industry as a whole and sets the tax rate, in effect does that. Exxon's not on here because they're not an operator, and obviously they will be an operator. They're an operator in Point Thompson. Point Thompson's not yet producing. But the principle will be the same. But the idea is the you know, if you look at the ASRC, CHM2 neighbors, all of these companies, they're doing work across the slope. Some of them may have a large relationship with one company or a large relationship with another, but fundamentally they're trying to do work across the slope. And when they do work, for example, in Prudhoe Bay, you know, that's it's not one-third, one-third, one-third. It's not quite. BP has a slightly smaller share. But the notion is, when they do work on the north on Prudhoe Bay, it is the three taxpayers who are picking up the results of that. And so this notion that well, we'll have some taxpayers doing this and some taxpayers doing that, as you know, the Prudhoe Bay constitutes. I'll really ding ahead to a slide here. You know, let's look at where the world is. Prudhoe Bay went all the way to 39, but you know, Prudhoe Bay constitutes most of the oil. Comparica is another big slug. Alpine is another slug. But all the work being done on Prudhoe Bay is going to go through to all three taxpayers. All the work going through being done in Comparica is going to go through all three taxpayers. Now, Exxon's going to be a very small piece of it. You know, but the point is, the work, the industry-wide work, in fact, may be best reflected by looking at an industry-wide number as opposed to going in and trying to parse out each taxpayer.
And we do have some questions here. So we've got
just a quick
Kawasaki, Edgman, and Guttenberg. But I just want to comment here, just what you've been talking about, is a structure that offers a beneficial bid variable to a lot of the support companies, and I believe that when we look at jobs in Prudhoe Bay, I think that's about 3% of our workforce, and we got the workforce development guys in effect, but in the back of the going back to memory, that's about 3% of the workforce, but it affects, Prudhoe Bay in itself affects about a third of our labor workforce. So that's how that bounces down. But again, trying to make sure we get to, I don't know if the right, the correct wording is, but a beneficial bid variable to make sure that credits are given, emphasized towards Alaskan companies. We've got Kawasaki, Edgman, and Seton. Or Guttenberg.
Just a really quick question on what the total employees are on one column, what the two number columns are.
Thank you. President Kawasaki, the chair, and I apologize. The Department of Labor reports a range. And as I simplified this to try to bring it down for a slide, that simply got lost. So that simply represents the category each one is in. So the 500 to 749 would then continue for the next five companies, and the 250 to 499 would then continue for the next four companies. So,
oh, I got you. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and that information is all available in a document that was released. I'm sure folks have seen it. The non-Alaska non-resident document that was released last month.
Yeah. So we have Edgman, Guttenberg, and Seton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to see a breakdown on the non-resident column of how many of those positions are actually fillable by Alaska residents, because obviously some of those are skill positions that our workforce just can't support, right? And so it would be interesting to me to see a breakdown of, you know, how many of those are labor positions that you could take a fisherman from Bristol Bay and just sort of put him in that position versus somebody who's a chemical engineer, something that would just, you know, they don't live in Alaska. I mean, so you have to pluck them out of Oklahoma, Louisiana, Texas, wherever they come from. So I think that would give me a better sort of understanding of really what the potential is to convert these jobs from non-residents to actually residents, if I could get that, Mr. Chairman. So.
Thank you. And we do have Gray Mitchell and Jeff Hadlin. And Jeff, could you raise your hand? And then Gray, just so committee members recognize who they are. And that's information that we can try and get from them. So I hope you're keeping your notes, Jeff. I see you back there nodding. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. From my perspective, you've taken this bill and show it as a jobs bill. And I just don't read it like that at all. Here it is. I mean, and I've worked up there most of my life. You know, you're basing it on total work hours. It's got nothing to do with wages. You're taking this revenue that the state of Alaska gets now, and you're basically buying jobs for people in the state of Alaska and then giving them hundreds of millions of dollars up on top of that. And there's nothing to say that those jobs are high-paying, high-skilled, the generational jobs that expand out you know, for the whole generation, the legacy jobs. You know, there's nothing to say that, you know, I know that this bill is going to come back with some major changes. You know, first of all, because according to the way this bill is written now, that if we build a mod in San Diego, those labor man hours are going to be counted towards Alaska Hire, and you're going to have hundreds or, you know, millions of hours on a project like that. So that's going to change, and I don't know how the next CS is going to have that. And there's nothing to say that there needed jobs up on the slope. They could be jobs that aren't needed. They could be summer jobs for Alaska college students. I'm not saying they don't need jobs, but you know, we've sat here for over 20 years. All kinds of people out of this legislature, you know, from you know, all the caucuses, and talked us blue in the face until we, you know, and the industry knows how important it is for us to put Alaskans to hire, and we're still fighting over it. Now we have a bill that basically says we are going to give you the money to hire these people. I'm not sure that's the right track. They should be hiring Alaskans because we're skilled and qualified. We're better at what we do than anybody else. And now we're going to give them hundreds of millions of dollars to hire us. We're basically subsidizing these jobs. I mean, you can see it in a context like that. If you hire another 125 Alaskans, we're going to give you you know, $250 million of tax breaks because you reach over something. We're not creating new jobs. We're not creating new investment. We're not saying all that money over that that we're going to be cutting and giving leeway is going to be required to put in new investment into the pipeline or putting new oil in, you know, down the line. We're giving you hundreds of millions of dollars to hire us when you should be doing it anyway. And really, if there was any calculation, you know, the industry tells us that we're too expensive to hire. It should be the difference between what it costs to hire to fly somebody up from Oklahoma or Texas as compared with hiring somebody out of Anchorage or the Kenai or Fairbanks. So I look at this quite a bit different than you do in the way you present it. And I've already been getting some comments back from folks at home who kind of see it like that. We're paying for Alaskan jobs. We're taking money that the state's getting it in revenue from our oil, and we're giving it to the industry to hire Alaskans. And I'm just scratching my head, and I'm not trying to figure out where that actually benefits. And it's not saying we're not building in efficiencies, we're building in inefficiencies. And if somebody's going to come to that table and tell me that everything on the slope is efficient, that they don't hire extra employees, then that's a fictitious as well, because I've sat on jobs where, you know, I watched people that had nothing to do. You know, I learned a long time in my youth that, you know, when those things were happening, somebody was doing the work, and I decided that's a lot more reward was there. But, you know, we still hear stories about the oil line, where buses full of people had nothing to do, were just hired, and it was part of the expenditures that the industry had. Can't blame them for that. There's huge inefficiencies built into these things. But we're paying them to hire our Alaskans that they should be doing anyway, and then we're giving them hundreds of millions of dollars more without any without knowing whether they're going to be putting more oil into the line or having those jobs being efficient or being legacy jobs. So I'm still real concerned about what we're doing. I know the bill's going to come out with some major changes because the sponsor, who unfortunately has a family situation that took him away. But, you know, I think you could write this in a whole nother dialogue, which would much more reflect this narrative, much more reflect a real situation, a real economy, a real economic evaluation of what these tax breaks are going to do for Alaskans up on the slope or in modules on the Kenai or wherever they are. So,
and we'll get into committee discussion, you know, when we get to that point. We can make sure that we get questions for Dan. A lot of good points by Representative Guttenberg. 4,000 out of the 17,000 people up there now are actually the big three. The others are little companies, I think. We do have Representative Seaton and Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dan, looking at the chart here on page 27, you see 15 companies or so, of which my understanding, well, since the production tax is a percent of profits, and, you know, you have those deductions and limitations where you start, it seems like what we're saying is there is going to be no impetus at all for 12 of those companies to hire any Alaskans, because it's not going to make any difference on their production tax, because they're participating, they're hiring people, but it doesn't matter whether they hire Alaskans or not, because they, under this scenario, they gain no benefit by hiring more Alaskans. And I realize it's big for the big three, but, you know, we've been really looking at ENI and Total and Shell and others coming in that don't have a production tax liability. And am I missing something? Does it come through the credits, or is it just the fact that this is targeting the production tax and therefore it's only a benefit to the production taxpayer?
Representative, I think that's exactly it. This is targeting the production tax. And again, I mean, I think the important thing is that the operators are the critical link between the taxpayers and the contractors. And that's, it's that three-step removal that I think is important. Mr. Chairman, so let me...
We did. I think we had one by Tuck and my friend Tuck, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I believe you were saying at one time, and I got to flip back in the slides here, so I should have done it already, that it's going to be workers that have to do with particular leases. Is that correct? When we talk about the resident versus non-resident hire?
Generally, Representative Tuck, through the chair, to be qualified, the labor has to be a lease expenditure, yes.
A lease expenditure. And when we look in slide 28 there,
okay,
does not include catering, security, engineering, transportation, communications, constructions. Are those typically positions that are held with lease expenditures or not?
Yes. I mean, when they are in the oil patch, those kinds of things are obvious, are deductible, are lease expenditures. So if you're doing catering or security for the you know, Kuparik, then that would be a lease expenditure for Kuparik. Same thing. So each of them, I mean, I guess the point is each of those things can happen outside of the oil and gas industry. They can happen as part of a different industry. It's just in Alaska they tend to be very predominantly oil industry.
Okay.
And they do represent allowable deductions.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. So we potentially, even though we didn't show those numbers because it's not really set out through the Department of Labor and Workforce Development for lease expenditures, potentially we can actually have some, like, for example, construction, because I know that when construction is going up there, we're concerned about making sure Alaskans get those jobs up there. So we can potentially reach into those other industries that this chart does not include.
Representative, talk to the chair. Yes, I think that the notion that I discussed with Representative Johnson was, but you look at who's doing the contracting on the North Slope. In other words, you look at the lease expenditures and then you track them back through. And if it's a catering company or an engineering company or a transportation company, then you'd make them part of that total equation.
I'm trying to make sure we're doing our housekeeping as we go along. We've had a request from Representative Edgman to try and get the number of new employees or how many employees could possibly be available for training, and if we can, maybe get the amount of money that has been put into training and request for pipeline training and oil field services training type of thing. But again, I've been sitting here trying to think about how to answer Representative Guttenberg's question on how this affects Alaskans, and just something to chew on here, and maybe revenue or labor can help us with this. So Jeff, hope you're keeping notes. When I look at, I think it's like 3% of the job force actually works in Prudhoe Bay, but it affects 30% of our labor workforce direct through categories such as engineering, transportation, communication, construction, et cetera. You know, I see that as maybe as a multiplier of 10. So how do you see that, you know, because those people go to Carr's Grocery Store and buy groceries and Steve's Food Boy and stuff. I don't know how a guy could ever try and figure that number out, but you know, when I just did from the 10,000 foot level and saying, well, if you're subsidizing this job or so-called subsidizing, actually you're just getting the states maybe getting a little bit less revenue in taxes, but if it creates this many jobs and economic multipliers by 10, I don't know how you'd ever figure that out. So, labor, there you are. Go ahead, Dan.
I thought Seaton had. Did you have one, Representative? Okay, thank you. One question I have is going back to what we talked about in a company not reporting and how they have a tax benefit for that. But what about the company that has a lot of subcontracting going along, but they themselves have a lot of local hire, and they don't report? They only report on what they have locally for themselves, but not reporting the subcontracting. How is that going to be able to attract, or are they will be able to get away with not reporting their contractors' hiring practices?
Representative Tucker, the chair. Yeah, I mean, all the taxpayers do lots and lots of contracting, and the point is, when you say not reporting, they have to take a hit. I mean, the way they don't report it is they simply don't ask for it as a deduction, and so there'll be a penalty to them for not reporting it. The problem is, this was the slide I was trying to address earlier, is the benefit outweighs the penalty. And so it makes sense to go through your own employees, through your operator's employees, and through all the subcontractors and say, I'm simply going to pluck out each non-resident and I'm not going to apply for them as a lease expense, so my taxes will go up. And under this bill, I get a benefit, my taxes go down, and the net effect is my taxes have gone down more than they've gone up. So it doesn't make sense to create a system, as the current bill might, where you would simply go through and pluck out the non-resident employees from all the categories, both the direct and then the subcontractors, everyone in between. And you don't, I mean, I think what you're identifying is it could just be your employees, it could be everyone, and you clearly don't want to create a situation that has that kind of an incentive.
Let's follow up. Thank you. So I still don't know where the checks and balances are for an employer who has predominantly local hire, but that subcontracts non-resident hire, but doesn't report to non-resident, only reports. Now, you gave us a situation where a person either reports or doesn't report. What if they report and don't report, and they don't report to the subcontractor? And then another part of that is there provisions in here where the State of Alaska Department of Revenue, I see that we can look and see who they've hired, but do we also get a chance to look at who they contract?
Rather than talk to the chair, yes. And in fact, I mean, one of the things that will happen, this bill aside, is most of the time and effort is going to be spent looking at contracting, because that's how most of the work that's being done. In other words, if you go back and say, you know, if you just look at the labor piece, roughly speaking, one quarter of the labor is going to be done by employees and three quarter of it is going to be done by contractors. So the contractors are the work done by the contractors and the modules they work on are the vast majority of the deductible lease expenses. So, again, the effect on a taxpayer by simply not reporting, not using a non-resident dollar that was spent to hire a non-resident to do lease work, is the same whether it's paid directly as a wage or bounces down through a contractor or a level of contract subcontractors.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll try and stay on the slide, the presentation. Have you gotten to slide 29 yet, which is the next one?
I have tried several times, but I have
okay.
not.
Okay, well, I'll get you there. Okay. So, you raised so obviously the top three bullets, well, all four bullets are very pertinent. How do you see these being addressed? Well, I see whether it's, how you deal with the professionals and the overhead labor and the contractor. I mean, there's... You know, it almost seems like to a certain extent, you know, the second bullet down is really problematic. But how do you, in your world, seeing these being addressed, why would we leave out an engineer on a project? Let's say you're building a mod and you need a lot of engineers at the site, on site, you know, when it gets here. Would there be a reason to leave them out?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, and this gets kind of to your earlier question about San Diego. No, here's the problem. The taxpayer is, let's say the taxpayer is Exxon. And so what they do is they get a bill from the operator, okay? Let's say it's North Slope, let's say it's Prudhoe Bay, so that's BP. And what BP has done is gotten a bill from a contractor. And what that contractor did was go out and have some things built using materials and labor. And, you know, so at each point, there's a bill being presented. I mean, if somebody goes to AIH, you know, and buys a $300 unit, right, they can install. Well, at some point, that was built by somebody using manufactured parts. So you can drill down how far. Now, you ask me, how would I look at that? I would probably look at some, level of size. So if it's X amount, you would break it down and try to break out labor, and if it weren't, you wouldn't. From 50,000 feet, you never pay for anything. You know, payments always go to other human beings, and so ultimately it's all, you know, won't get into theories of labor and everything. But yet, these are issues which I think it makes sense to figure out in statute as opposed to leaving to regulation, because they could be very problematic. And I think the Department of Revenue did a very good job of sort of outlining those issues and showing the wide range there.
Thanks, and I guess this is getting back to the question I asked earlier about, right now we have a limitation on allowable expenses, and this is going to saying not only do we have allowable expenses, but we're having required expenses. And so we're going to have a whole other situation where we say we are now going to mandate that these hours and these, if somebody's building a compressor station, compressor skid module and bringing up, we are going to be, mandate that the hours that we're in building that compressor module are now going to be lease expenditures. We're not going to leave that up to the company to declare what their lease expenditures are. We're going to be basically taking over their tax, their writing their taxes for them, not limiting their taxes or limiting what they can deduct, but mandating what they can deduct. And I'm wondering whether that gives us additional, a lot of additional problems.
Repetitive seating through the chair, and I'm being back to slide 24. I think if you look at the four options I've outlined here for solving that particular problem, I think option number two, it hits the nail. I think the description you've just made hits number two. And I think that's when I was discussing with Representative Johnson, for example, who's going, well, you know, that'd be a whole bunch more rules. And so, no, I mean, I think people look at that and go, that's not the most appropriate way of solving the incentive problem that I identified earlier. I think if you look at number four there, I don't think it mandates.
And can you explain that again? I'm
lost. The incentive problem or the difference
between? No, number four.
Okay.
I'd like to try and make sure, too, that we get a little bit of a chance to get pages, the last 10 pages in the last 9 minutes on.
Okay. I'll spend two minutes on this one. Representative Seaton, the notion behind number four is that since you really only have three taxpayers responsible for about 90%, 97%+ of the tax, and they're all basically in the same sets of units and hiring the same kinds of contractors, that if you went and looked at the overall ratios of those contractors and let that set the tax rate for all three major taxpayers, there wouldn't be any, I mean, there wouldn't be any major winners, there wouldn't be any major losers. I mean, we tend to sit here and think of taxes like, you know, federal income tax with hundreds and hundreds of taxpayers. There aren't. There's three, and they're all basically going to the same source. And so my notion was, and I think Representative Johnson was comfortable with this notion, that if you base it on what's happening industry-wide, then those three taxpayers are going to be driving towards getting the industry to hire more residents. And so you're not mandating anything. You're not saying here's what the rules are. What you're saying is the tax rate will be set within a certain range based on the behavior of these, again, how you define exactly, but basically looking at the 10 or 15 or 20 employers who are driving, you know, ultimately through all these curlicues back through contractors and subcontractors and operators to working interest owners.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah, we got 10 pages and we got 8 minutes.
Well,
go ahead, Nash.
If I can, I'm thinking that number four, which is what we're kind of proposing here, gets us to not having a company-specific profit tax rate. We're trying to calculate a uniform tax rate, but for three different companies that have. Am I understanding that that's a proposal?
And Representative Seaton through the chair.
Rates aren't even written yet.
Yeah, Representative Seaton through the chair. The net tax is still in place. The profits determine how much base you're multiplying by. The resident hire would determine what the rate is. So the tax you have is going to be a rate times a base. All the work that you've done creating what that base is still in place. That hasn't been touched. If you're losing money, no tax. If you're making a ton of money, a lot of tax. But that's multiplied times a rate, and the rate is determined by your local hire. But same thing, if you think about federal income tax, there's four sets of rates. If you're an individual or you're married or you're a surviving spouse, there's different sets of rates sort of depending on who you are, and it's applied to the same base. So I think you can keep those two separate. You haven't changed the structure of the net tax. You've just made the that rate variable dependent on
local hire.
Right. So the reduction is available in the base rate if you elect so when you hire a license. And that's why I make sure we try, because we've got Dan today, before we get to Representative Kawasaki, and these guys are available at labor and stuff, and revenue. Is there anything in the next few pages that we really need to get to, Dan, that you think are issues?
Mr. Chairman,
well, there's lots of good questions, but a lot of these
let me
ask directed towards revenue or labor or law.
Mr. Chairman, what I mean, most sense is for me to quickly explain what's in these pages so people want to look at them afterwards very quickly. The next section really deals with a 30% well credit and deals with the differences between putting that in 023 and 025. Right now, there are three credit sections. And where you put this credit sort of...
Page number?
Excuse me. Page 34. Sorry. Thank you. And then on page 35, you have a difference between the definitions for well work between what the governor proposed and what is what the language here. And I tried to line up the pieces so you can just sort of go across and see how they compare.
Thank you.
And then finally, on the last piece, Mr. Chairman, on slide 37, basically just very quickly summarizes that you have a statute of limitations change proposed here. It was 3 years. In other words, that the Department of Revenue had 3 years to set the amount of tax due. Typically, that three-year statute was not met, and there were extensions. You then went forward to a situation where in 2007, it was extended out to 6 years for production taxes. And this bill would bring you back into the time frame of 3 years. And just from one of the points I want to identify in here, because a lot of people may not understand this, in the case of a false return or a fraudulent return, or if you can show intent to evade tax, the statute of limitations doesn't apply. The statute of limitations just applies for a disagreement, an audit, going in and making a determination about somebody thinking about the words differently. People typically talk about the difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion, and if you're looking at the tax avoidance issues, that's really where the statute of limitation plays in. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the rest of it, and then the last slide on there, which I work, as everyone people know, I work this last slide into every single presentation, and 38. I wasn't able 39, and I wasn't able to get in this one, so I just stuck it at the end because I think it really looking at that sort of helps everyone understand where we are. The difference between 20 years ago when we were producing 2 million barrels a day and the world today when we're producing 600,000 or less than a third of that.
And that's something that maybe we should all keep on our desks and look at, you know, on how that's affecting Alaska. And I know that everybody in this building is very, very aware of it and where we're going in on the future of this. We do have House Bill 337 that was read across the floor on February 10th, which is the governor's bill, rules by request of the governor, an act relating to interest on certain underpayments or overpayments of oil and tax production credits and various fees for that for local hire and stuff like that. And so that bill's been through there, so make sure you're aware of it. And we will try and make sure that we have some of the folks who are writing the regulations actually come in front of us and talk to us at a different time. There was a lot of good questions asked today. Means you guys are doing your work and thinking about it like we should be doing, and so continue the good work on that end. We do have, again, guys from labor here. We've got a list of names available from Department of Law, Aaron Paulin and Gary Rogers from Revenue, and Sherry Niehaus from Revenue, and we've got Administrative Director from Revenue in the back of the room here. So if you've got questions, you can get it that way. Kevin Banks, if you got questions, please direct them through the chair, or work directly with these guys if you have to. If you don't get answers, bring them to the chair, and then we'll see what we can do to try and make sure everybody's questions are answered and continue rolling along there.
Mr. Chairman, I think Representative Kawasaki, I think we did cover the two questions that you had raised by the time.
Not completely.
Okay.
Yeah, and a lot of this, you know, again, what I always have contended is the process that we go through here in the committee process is a learning process. It's a discovery process, and through the way we'll continue to move on. With that, we will adjourn for the day if we have no more questions. Thank you.